Hello, SFIA audio listeners. In this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters, we'll take a look at what sorts of alien behemoths might be possible under known science. To hear it and every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur. Many a brave space traveler in the future may journey to alien planets to try the cuisine. And who can blame them? For as we'll see today, alien beer is to die for. So welcome to another impromptu episode of Science and Futurism with IsaacArthur, and I am your aforementioned host, IsaacArthur. And today's topic is all about alien beer and alien food in general, and if that sounds like an appetizing topic, make sure to hit the like and subscribe buttons. Alien food and drink is a classic trope in science fiction, and while it's often portrayed as not too appetizing to look at, it tends to be alien in form but entirely compatible with our food and function. Alternatively, alien booze tends to be something seen as contraband and exciting for that reason, or amazingly potent and dangerous, and today we'll ask how true that would be and why. And for those wondering why there's an episode today, I was planning this topic as one of our experimental shorts, and as is often the case, I quickly realized there was no way I was squeezing the topic of alien food and drink into a 60-second video. Still, I think I kept the topic short enough you might not need a drink or a snack to get through it, and that might be a good thing, since as we'll see today, contrary to what we see in science fiction, alien cuisine and drink is not likely to be palatable. Also, given the topic, I will note that this episode isn't really for kids. Now, the title is a bit of a long-running joke on the show, dating back to our episode Parasitic Aliens, and that wonderful animation Ken York made after watching the episode, of the aliens standing around at a table drinking beer, and one falls over dead. But while beer is the most amusing part of it, the concept is really about the incompatibility of organisms between planets, and how that doesn't always matter. Fundamentally, viruses and many other types of parasites all evolved to work on a very specific organism, which is why you would rarely catch the flu from a cat or a dog or vice versa, as it is a virus that is basically a stripped-down and specialized machine for hacking one specific species and using its own cells to get stuff done. You won't transmit that to your cat, let alone a fish, and definitely not to an alien, even one that's humanoid in shape. So the common sci-fi trope of catching an alien virus, be it a flu or STD, is probably not much of a concern. But while a lot of bacteria are specialized about the environment they can live in, and dependent on other organisms in their environment to properly function, many will do just fine in an otherwise sterile environment. They just need those basic building blocks of life to live and copy themselves, which potentially makes them handy for terraforming new and dead planets, but also makes them potentially handy for re-terraforming already living planets, and to a new biology. We just had our regular weekly episode earlier this week on the ethics of terraforming planets, and the major discussion there was about handling planets that already had some life on them, particularly ones with only very basic microbes, as opposed to intelligent alien people or cute and cuddly aliens. And a critical issue there is that unlike in sci-fi, it's not really going to be possible to mix terrestrial and alien life on a given planet, even if it uses the same basic chemistry and nutrients. But that's more about bacteria, and we'll return to that and alien beer in a bit. Fiction loves showing us weird alien cuisine, and it's an intriguing idea for discussion, and emphasize alien customs. I think my first encounter with it was in Star Trek The Next Generation, where we see Commander Riker trying to prepare for a diplomatic exchange mission, serving as a temporary first officer on a Klingon ship by eating all sorts of horrifying-looking traditional Klingon food. And then when he gets to the Klingon ship, he finds out that a lot of it is meant to be eaten while still alive, and he does a very literal gut check before digging in. In a later episode, Commander Kern from the Klingons, who turns out to be Worf's long-lost brother, comes on board the Enterprise to return the favor and says he shall try some of their burned, replicated bird meat. And both are good episodes for highlighting cultural differences with aliens, but also highlight the same problem we see with half-breed aliens like Spock, or Deanna Troi, or Worf's own son, where they are fun for storytelling but not really plausible for science, as opposed to Michael Burnham from Star Trek Discovery, Spock's foster sister, a human raised by a Vulcan and a human, culturally influenced by both, but genetically just the one. Now, as we discussed in episodes like Multi-Species Civilizations and Coelian Habitats, with sufficient science and determination, you can crossbreed anything you feel like, even something that doesn't have DNA. It just depends on how far you're willing to go and how broadly you consider the criteria for a successful mix. You might be content with something that merely externally looks like a combination of both. So too, we can probably engineer gut bacteria for people or aliens that would let them digest some biologically similar compounds for actual nutrient. But most of the time, your best case scenario for eating something alien is going to be your body treating it like fiber. No calories, but no falling over dead, or having some alien monster pop out of you after growing in your stomach or eating you. Let's put the caveat in there that the basic building blocks of amino acids are pretty universal, and not only likely to be found in a lot of alien ecosystems, but floating around in the interstellar void. And while there is 9 essential amino acids, and 11 non-essential amino acids that are standard in our biology, there are a lot more that might exist within alien ecologies. You might be able to use them with your existing enzymes, or vice versa, some alien megafauna might be able to eat you and digest your proteins, but it's also a lot more plausible we could genetically tailor some new enzymes that could do the job, or that they might evolve. And of course, whether or not it finds you tasty, or even non-toxic, might not stop it from trying you out as a snack, or simply attacking you for territorial reasons. That's just proteins and amino acids, though, and those might be common enough in nature as a basis for life, much as it wouldn't surprise us to find things which ran on water and breathed oxygen, but that leaves a lot of room for differences. Eating something is not the same as breeding with it, though, for all that a lot of creatures on Earth, and probably off Earth too, often consume their mates. We can eat nearly any living thing on Earth, though we can't always safely and usefully digest it. And of course, digest doesn't mean got food from. They might have photosynthesis or carbs or sugars, and we might be able to digest them, especially with time to research and create an enzyme, or with some cybernetic enhancements, but none of that implies compatible tastes or prevents allergic reactions. Even if we could digest alien food, there's the question of whether it would provide the nutrients we need. Human bodies require specific vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and other nutrients in certain proportions. Alien food might lack these, or contain them in forms that are unusable or toxic to us. Just as with amino acids, the difference in structure could mean that alien sugars are not just indigestible, but potentially toxic. For example, some sugars might be metabolized into harmful substances, or interfere with normal functioning of metabolic pathways. Getting sick, nauseous, or even hallucinating is quite probable. As we say with mushrooms, they come in 3 kinds. Those that feed you, those that kill you, and those that let you see God for a few days. Speaking of toxicity, though, one example I see a lot in fiction is insanely potent beverages, super beer or the like. Just to be clear, alcohol is a chemical with a specific effect on your body based on how much you drink. You can only make it so dense. And sort of like the food cubes that were ubiquitous in science fiction back in the day, and had a whole meal squeezed into something the size of an ice cube, that's not really how that works. Your basic 3 macronutrients, carbs, protein, and fat, have about 4, 4, and 9 calories per gram respectively, and which would generally be on an order of 1 cubic centimeter per gram, less for sugar, which is denser than water, more for oil, which is less dense than water, and water is 1 gram per cubic centimeter. Oil, like olive oil, is basically as calorie dense as you can get, and a food cube 1 inch on each side would have 132 calories in it. That wouldn't survive compression, and since space is not at a premium in space, just mass, compressing your food to a smaller size wouldn't seem to make much sense anyway. It would still weigh as much. If you're curious, alcohol is about 7 calories a gram, and a standard drink has 14 grams of alcohol, just over a cubic inch if it were in pure alcohol format. Beer is mostly water, so we'd say your typical 12-ounce or 1/3 of a liter bottle would have about 14 grams of alcohol. It's typically 4-6% alcohol by volume, or ABV, or 8-12 proof, as proof is just double the ABV. Wine's usually around double that, and most liquor runs between 35-50% alcohol. The bivalium point matters because alcohol is about 4/5 the density of water, so a liter of water weighs 1 kilogram, but a liter of alcohol is 0.79 kilograms. And if you mix those two together, that mix would be 50% ABV or 100 proof, but only 44.1% of that mass or weight is alcohol. You can't make alcohol any stronger than 200 proof, and it's not going to make you any drunker than having two equal-sized glasses of something 100 proof or four of something 50 proof. Generally, there's no point drinking the stuff except to hurt your throat, but anything over 50% ABV or 100 proof can also be lit on fire at room temperature, and 80 proof will burn if warmed up, for cooking flambé, for instance, which is obviously not something you should be doing while drinking. This episode is coming out the week before St. Patrick's Day, and not long before spring break either, so let me add in the reminder that if you're going to drink, do it responsibly. And that includes drinking a lot of water, too. A lot of the nasty effects of alcohol relate to dehydration, so lower-proof drinks are smarter in that regard, too. Now, it wouldn't be that weird for a biology similar to ours to get the same effect as us off alcohol. Not that it would be very likely, either. And alien alcohol itself probably is just fine if it is alcohol, rather than some substance that parallel the effect but not the chemistry. Why we say alien beer in particular is dangerous is because it's not really the chemicals we're all that worried about, it's the biological organisms in the drink, and unless it's pasteurized, yeast in beer is still alive. The beer you get at the store is usually not going to have a live culture in it, but our joke derives from the notion of homebrewing and bootlegging. A lot of times in fiction, alien drinks or chemicals are serious contraband, sometimes in a strictly political way like Romulan ale is, where it's the setting equivalent to a Cuban cigar, banned for embargo rather than health concerns. But the reality is that it's very unlikely you would allow intra-ecosystem trade in food, as it just comes with so many red flags for problems. And that leads to the idea of smuggling. Everybody is going to want to try it. And here it's even worse to seek to make it locally, as you cannot just pasteurize it with a good chance of wiping out some invasive species of microbe or yeast. You need live yeast for making yogurt or beer or cheese, and if you want the alien kind, you have to use the alien microorganisms, which if they can work on some food you can digest, means they can survive in our environment, meaning you have now basically unleashed something not much short of a gray goo outbreak on your planet. Folks introducing alien microbes into an existing environment might be considered serious criminals, depending a lot on how good your genetic engineering or nanobots are. You could, in theory, brew up vats of beer or yogurt or cheese using alien microbes, and maybe safely by having the place be off-world or like a biohazard lab, but odds are it would be banned on general principle. Now, as everyone knows, the only thing that makes a cigar or drink better is if it comes from someplace under embargo and sanction. And let's be honest, if someone offered you a forbidden alien beer, you're going to have a rough time saying no, and aren't likely to report them. This also means there's now a black market for it. Only anyone supplying it is not likely to be making it in an ultra-safe biohazard lab, but rather brewing it up in their bathtub like moonshine. So next thing you know, you've been invaded by aliens and your ecosystem wrecked, not because they're parasitic or bad guys, but because someone couldn't resist having a drink. And who can blame them? After all, alien beer is to die for. As a quick announcement, we're running another episode topic poll today, March 10th, to select an episode or two to do, and you can choose from our four candidates: cyborg civilizations, oceanic launch platforms, self-repairing machines, and what if you are a clone? So don't forget to head over to our channel's YouTube community tab to vote, and don't forget to set your clock forward if you live in a daylight savings time area. Alright, that will wrap us up for today's impromptu episode, which I actually wrote yesterday afternoon, as opposed to 3 months early like normal, and actually follows from a couple episodes coming out in May: Alien Embassies, Cosmic Capitals, and Space Freighters, as I found myself wondering about what the typical diplomat or space freighter crew member would do at ports of call, and of course, eating and drinking tend to be classic ways of passing the time. Plus, my 5-year-old son Gio was asking me what dinosaurs tasted like. Speaking of ports of call, we'll be traveling to the Martian moons of Phobos and Deimos this Thursday to look at using them as waypoints to help us explore and settle Mars, and a week from now we'll explore the use of artificial intelligence in our legal system in automated justice, and we'll talk more about the concept of alien microorganisms on Thursday, March 21st, in our episode The Fermi Paradox, Real Complexity. If you'd like to get alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to hit the like, subscribe, and notification buttons. You can also help support the show on Patreon. And if you'd like to donate or help in other ways, you can see those options by visiting our website, isaacauthor.net. You can also catch all of SFIA's episodes early and ad-free on our streaming service Nebula, along with hours of bonus content like Crystal Aliens at go.nebula.tv/isaacauthor. As always, thanks for watching and have a great week.